books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, I chat with the American novelist responsible for books such as The Foreign Student, American Woman, and the National Book Award winner for fiction, Trust Exercise. Susan Choi talks to me about her novel, Flashlight. Flashlight by Susan Choi is described as a thrilling, globe-spanning novel that mines questions of memory, language, identity, and family. The audio version is read by Eunice Wong.
Louisa and her father are making their way down the breakwater, each careful step on the heaved granite blocks, one step farther from shore. Her mother is not even on the shore, for example, seated smiling on the sand. Her mother is shut inside the small, almost waterfront house they are renting, most likely in bed. All summer, Louisa has played in the waves by herself, because her mother isn't well, and her father is unvaryingly dressed in a jacket and slacks. But tonight, he has finally agreed to walk the breakwater with her. She has asked every day since they first arrived. Spray from the waves sometimes lands on the rocks, and so he has carefully rolled up the cuffs of his slacks. He still wears his hard, polished shoes. In one hand, he holds a flashlight, which is not necessary. In the other hand, he holds Louisa's hand, which is also not necessary. She tolerates this out of kindness.
One thing I will always owe your mother is she taught you to swim, because swimming is important to know how to do for your safety. But when she gave you lessons, I thought it was too dangerous. I was very unfair.
I hate swimming. They both know the opposite is true. Perhaps her father recognizes her comment for what it partly is, a declaration of loyalty to him, as well as for what it mostly is, a declaration by a 10-year-old child who is contentious by reflex.
Flashlight is a novel that is, at its core, about a very small, not particularly happy family. Louisa, who is 10 years old when we meet her and her mother and father. Mother Anne is an American, Father Cirque is not. And his background is he's an ethnic Korean who grew up in Japan, but it's a little more complicated than even Louisa or her mother know. He's not prone to talking about himself, but he does take them back to Japan where he grew up. And the trip is a catastrophe. The exact way in which it's a catastrophe, I'm trying to kind of keep that card to my chest in order for the reader to be able to enjoy the way the book unfolds. But Louise and her mother return to the U.S. alone. And then we follow everyone forward sort of from this moment of impact that busts the family up as they discover kind of what exactly happened to them and why.
Far over the water, far beyond where the breakwater joins with a thin spit of sand, the sunset has lost all its warmth and is only a paleness against the horizon. They'll turn back soon.
I never learned to swim,
her father reveals. I don't believe you, she scoffs. Everybody can swim. Though it's true he always makes a big deal when she wants to get in or even get near the water.
It's true. I grew up a poor boy. I had no YMCA.
The YMCA is disgusting. I hate going there.
Someday, you'll feel thankful to your mother. But I want you to act thankful now.
These are the last words he ever says to her. Or are they the last words that she can remember? Did he say something more? There's no one to ask.
Now, the headline I've seen a couple of times when researching this is, it's an alternate universe version of your family. How much of it is true?
This is something that I'm saying, to be honest, under direct questioning, because there is a tendency to kind of point out that there are a few autobiographical overlaps between my actual family and this very fictional family. And it is very true that a childhood trip to Japan when I was young, which did not result in catastrophe, happily, or really anything in particular, was my original impetus for writing the book because it had made such an impression on me. But it only made an impression on me. And, you know, as an adult writer, and I say that because I did scribbling as a kid too, but as an adult writer, you know, you come to recognize that you need a real story. What had happened to my family wasn't a story. We went to an overseas country. I'd never been to such a place. And so I was quite impressed. But as I began my, you know, writing career and started realizing what you need for a plot, I knew that would never do. So this book comes out of my interest in the history of the region, in some real life events in that region that did not affect my family, but that I sort of, you know, kind of in this alchemy wanted to see, like, well, what if those had affected my family? You know, what if we had been subjected to such forces? And so I think that's kind of where this idea of like a dark side or alternate universe version of my life comes from. The book strays pretty far away from my autobiography pretty quickly. And also I hope that the character of Louisa, who I make into a very difficult child, doesn't reflect me. My mother says that I was a very nice child, so I'm hoping she's right.
Of course, Japan in the 1970s would have been very different to the Japan we know today.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, I think, one of the reasons I so wanted to write about that experience for so long, because it wasn't just that it was a Japan of my childhood that felt a little bit like a dream state, but also a Japan that I think is so far removed from contemporary Japan. It was really a profoundly different place. The forces of Western culture had made not very much of a dent. I remember two experiences of mine that I, you know, allude to in the book, in the way that I, you know, borrowed little bits and pieces of my childhood memory to try to lend verisimilitude to the book, was going with my father to the very first McDonald's that opened in Osaka, and kind of the mob scene of I think bemused, but also like, you know, riveted Japanese people kind of checking out, like, what was this sort of phenomenon, the American beef burger. And also in the book, I make use of a memory that I have of seeing the movie Close Encounters of the First Kind in Japan, and what a sort of spectacle this was as well, of like two cultures that really had not had a lot of interaction, kind of trying to interact with each other, you know, sort of early on. And so it does feel like a lost, you know, lost land. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to try to recreate it.
This is a complete aside, but we went to the first McDonald's in London years ago and kept a couple of the spoons and things. But one thing I've got downstairs is McDonald's ashtrays.
Oh, well, that's right. That's right. Yes, I remember vividly from my childhood. Well, there used to be all kinds of ashtrays that you could collect from various places. I don't mourn the decline of smoking, but I will say, as a New Yorker, when the smoking ban was enacted, I never thought it would work. I, you know, like so many New Yorkers, we all went, oh, that'll never work. And of course, now you see someone smoking indoors, it's like a shock. It's as if they've stripped all their clothes off. It seems like completely, like, culturally just so out there.
Yeah, you used to work at the New Yorker, which would be fueled on coffee and cigarettes.
That's right, I did. And it was the mid-1990s. And when I came to work there, smoking had been banned all across the offices, except in the case of one emeritus figure who was so esteemed by all of us and really considered to be so inseparable from his cigarettes that he was sort of grandfathered in, and he would sit in his office and smoke would just issue continually forth, even though everyone else was forbidden to smoke. And there was something kind of, there was a grandeur to it that was kind of nice to see. It wasn't good for him, of course, but.
Talking out of flashlight though, how was the research behind the book? Obviously, some of it is memory, but some of it you would have had to look up.
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, just to set the proportions kind of correctly, a bit of it was memory and most of it I had to look up, the vast bulk of it. The research, you know, kind of came in these waves. I like research because it's a very virtuous form of procrastinating on the actual rather difficult thing of trying to write the story. And so if I can smell an excuse to do research, I might do it forever and think, oh, I'll start the writing tomorrow. I just need to read this one more thing. So there was this initial kind of orgy of research where I just plunged in and did a lot of reading about I mentioned these kind of real life historical events impacting Japan that were contemporaneous with when I was there as a child, had no impact whatsoever on my childhood, my family. We were utterly ignorant of these events, which only emerged later. And so in a way, that was a first spark to trying to finally write this book. So I spent a lot of time researching, you know, Asian politics. And it's just, I came very close to going too far and then, you know, forced myself to start working. But once a story is underway, and especially like once it starts taking real shape, then always these additional research problems start popping up. And that's at a point where the research is less appealing and kind of the momentum of the story is a little more appealing, at least for me. And so once I finally got going, then I would run up against things that I did not know, had not realized I would need to know. And I'd kind of be like, oh God, no, now I have to go back and do more research. So I would go back and do more. And then I would say there were multiple waves of kind of research writing my way into corners of ignorance, researching again to try to get out of them, process repeats. And, you know, even really down to the very last revision, there were all sorts of brand new paroxysms of research happening. And it was cumulatively, it was quite a lot, but I learned a lot. So that was the upside.
Louisa lay awake, staring into the dark. The ceiling showed itself in a narrow stripe of light, first sharp like a blade, and then more and more soft, that crossed the ceiling from the doorframe. The door was very slightly cracked open because Louisa was afraid of the dark. This didn't used to be the case. Every night, with maddening slowness, her mother would retreat from the room, clumsily bumping her wheels to a point that Louisa would want to scream at her. When her mother was finally out in the hall, she hesitated, one hand on the doorknob, the door almost, but not fully, shut. "Close it all the way, please," Louisa would say in a sharp, grown-up tone. The first time she'd said this, it was because she couldn't stand another second of her mother being there, peering in through the crack. Then she said it every subsequent night the same way, having realized that it was, without being a wrong thing to say, satisfyingly hurtful.
And much more from Susan Choi after this.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Every weekday on RNIB Connect Radio, we bring you a classic RNIB talking book, serialised and played in full over time.
The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde.
The Old Curiosity Shop by Charles Dickens.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson.
You'll hear much-loved novels and timeless favourites brought to life by some truly brilliant narrators who know how to let a story breathe.
Hello, I'm Richard Burnett.
Hello, I'm John Cormack.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagen.
Join us every weekday at 2 p.m. with the repeat at 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
I'm Michael Palin, and you're listening to Talking Books
only on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The very first books in the studios were recorded on wax disc.
Of course, recording on wax discs means that you have to have a one take, basically. If you make a mistake during that recording, the whole disc is just wiped clean. So you have these narrators we had then had to record for about 25 minutes without making a mistake, and they were really adept at covering over mistakes, apparently. I remember one of our narrators called Andrew Timothy, who used to talk to us about recording on wax discs, and he was very clear about what he has to do. If he made a mistake, he didn't actually make a mistake, he just sort of covered it over and carried on recording. And one of his favourite things he used to say is that the important thing is, you say a word that you've never heard of before, say it with such conviction that people who have been saying it correctly for the last 20 years are now wondering whether they are saying it correctly.
Quickly and with confidence.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now our return to my chat with American novelist Susan Troy about her novel. The audio version is read by Eunice Wong.
"What's that flashlight for?" Louisa asked him, and his mind had to spring to flashlight and pretend the question was one he'd expected. The flashlight stood on the windowsill, bulb end pointing down. The windows in the room were very large and high, with very deep sills, and the deep sills were very cluttered, as every surface in the room was cluttered. There were potted plants set close together, and in the bits of space between them, ugly artworks made from balls and tubes of clay incompetently stuck together, and other knick-knacky arts and crafts garbage Louisa supposed other children had made during appointments. The flashlight hardly stood out. Dr. Brickner had to crane his neck around in awkward, almost panic, to find what she was talking about.
"It's to see in the dark," he said clownishly.
"You have lights." He abandoned the clowning.
"It's in case of a power outage, which doesn't happen often, but it could happen, especially if there's an earthquake."
"Where I lived before I moved here, I felt earthquakes all the time."
"In Japan."
She was disappointed somehow that he already knew this. But of course he already knew everything.
Have you ever had to go back and change the book after doing some research and thinking, oh, that couldn't happen?
I mean, not in really fundamental ways, like not changing something that I've already decided is taking place, or, you know, making a massive correction. But it does often happen that doing the research points you toward things that you haven't included, that it starts to seem like a really conspicuous absence in the story. Like, I think there was a moment where I was kind of really deep in the weeds about Japan and Korea and how they're feeling about each other in the post-World War II moment. And then I thought, oh yeah, China. I'd better mention China here. So just moments like that where you realize, like, oh, you know, it's this particular year on the planet Earth. This particular event is probably gonna have had major reverberations. And so it's mostly just adding and adding and adding. And I think one of the challenges I always encounter when trying to write about any past period is, like, how do you include enough for the reader, but not too much?
It's like a balancing act between historical accuracy and the freedom of fiction.
Yeah, and it's a balancing act between, I think also, you know, trusting the reader and giving them the space to experience the story and make their own connections, and not wanting to bewilder, if that makes sense. And it's also going to be different considerations for different audiences. And admittedly, because I am an American and I reside in the US, I think at some sort of square one level, I'm always thinking first of the American readership. And I know that this is not the the best place to say that, but it is the first sort of thought is often in terms of repairing gaps where I think like, you know, does the American readership know about this aspect of East Asian history? You know, do I need to fill in more? Am I talking down to them now? Do I need to subtract? And it could be similar for really any readership that isn't kind of a Japanese or a Korean readership. And that's interesting to think about. You know, if the book is translated, I do wonder, you know, will readers in that part of the world think like, oh my God, I can't believe she's explaining this in this way. Or will they think, oh, this is interesting. You know, I wasn't actually that aware of this particular dimension of our history. You know, it's hard to know.
Let's just say it wouldn't be translated for North Korea.
I doubt it. And yeah, but you know, yes, I agree with you there. But what one of the things that one does think about is culture of different sorts is getting in there all the time. And I don't pretend to hope that my book would ever make it within that very, you know, that very closed off nation. But it's really interesting the things that do make it past those borders and that do connect with the people living there, as we find out later when some of them do manage to leave.
Yeah, just did an interview a few months back with Charlie English, and his book was called The CIA Book Club. It was about that very thing. It was smuggling books in. It was behind the Iron Curtain, not to North Korea, but smuggling books into to seed dissent. So you never know.
You never know. And it's you know, it's one of those things that kind of feels both, it's like, it's kind of an awesome responsibility and also sort of exciting, the thought that something that you make, whether it's a book or some other cultural product, you know, movie, music, that it can possibly make its way to a very different audience than you expected and maybe have a very different impact than you expected, hopefully positive.
Flashlight grew from a short story into a much larger work. Did it just want to be written, or, well, what made you realize that there was a much bigger story in there?
Yeah, its process of evolution was a little bit the opposite direction from what it might seem, because it was already a book that I was really grappling with. Like I, you know, just was kind of floundering about on the inside of this idea already, and already was trying to understand how to make it a novel. I had my characters. I sort of had the big basics of what was going to befall them. And I could not find my way in to how to tell the story to the reader. And so the short story that came out in late 2020 by the same title was a product of like those big struggles with a book that was not letting me get my arms around it at all. And so I had the thought like, you know, I wonder if I can just skip ahead in the sequence of events that I'm imagining, because I was quite stuck on some of the major ones, and just, you know, write about the characters after these things have happened to them as if they've already happened. Well, you know, not just as if they'd already happened, but assuming they'd already happened, but as if I'd already written the bits in which they'd happened. And that's what that story was it was really kind of an exercise in me trying to get unstuck on this much larger idea that already, as I say, was kind of defeating me. And so it wasn't the wrote the short story and then thought, oh, let's make this bigger. It was more the, oh my God, this is too big. How might I make it smaller for the moment?
Was Louisa channeling you when she wasn't, or she was avoiding the psychologist's questions, but she couldn't resist the urge to keep talking?
Yeah. It's interesting. I wasn't that kind of child. I was a really, so Louisa in the story is she is truculent, that's a word in our language I really like. She's a really truculent, you know, a wayward child. She's behaving horribly. She's been sent to a child psychologist because she's not just not doing well in school. She is constantly stealing small objects that are meaningful from their owners. She's sort of become like this little shoplifter, except not in shops. And I was so far from this kind of child that I almost think I was kind of, you know, fascinated by like, what might it have been like to be the child who behaves horribly when feeling horribly. She's feeling horribly, of course. And so she's acting that way. And, you know, I was a child who I do remember having plenty of difficult moments, but I was very, very concerned with rules and utterly terrified to break them and really to almost a comic degree. I mean, I remember my mother often having to phone the school and ask them for clarification because I was, you know, in a paralysis of anxiety about, you know, oh, I'm supposed to do this, but I don't understand exactly what's meant. And, you know, so I think this is like a little bit of a fantasy fulfillment for me that she was, you know, she's a pain in the butt for sure, but she has this kind of bravado to her in her rebellions against the world of the adults that, you know, I certainly never had that, but maybe a little bit wish I had.
We follow Louisa for quite a while, but there are different timelines, different characters. In a book like this, how do you keep track as an author?
I often do not, to be honest. And, you know, one of the really comic moments for me in the composition of this book is, and I've described this before, the moment at which I was so honestly confused about what I had written, what had happened in the story, when exactly it had taken place, because I was writing this book in a really scattershot sort of manner, going kind of like hopscotching almost from character to character, thinking about these different people. You know, it's not just Louisa and her mother and her father, but Louisa turns out to have this half-brother that she never knew existed until she, you know, is maybe 8 years old, who like pops up. And then there's other people who come in as well and have an impact on the story. And I kind of was writing from the person. And so, you know, I'd write a little about this person, and then I'd kind of go over here and be like, oh, you know, what's this person up to? How are they being affected? And the mass of material was so bewildering. I had no idea even like when events were happening with respect to each other. And I had this brilliant idea to go and put all of the sections in chronological order of when they happened. And I hadn't even done that. So I think the answer is, for me, it's quite hard to keep track. I often end up making these, what you might call an outline, but after the fact, not before. You know, I think the organized person makes an outline first and then writes from it. And the disorganized person writes first and then makes an outline to sort of map out like what they've done. And I do a lot of that. I made a lot of tables of contents of the novel in progress just so that I had like a one-sheeter that kind of I could look at and go like, oh, right, okay, this happened, and then I've got this going on, and then this person shows up, and then that person, you know, it's, I often think that like I should probably have an entire wall of bulletin board or something, but I tend to not be able to invent an organizational method that lasts. So with this book, lots of tables of contents.
I don't know if you have this phrase in America, but in the UK, I've heard writers fall into two camps of either a plotter or a pantser. Basically, pantsers are writing by the seat of their pants. There's no plot, there's no direction. They just write and see where it goes.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I'm a pantser for sure. I love that. Thank you for that. I've never heard that term in my life. And that's really, I find it quite cheery. It sort of brings a really vivid, cheerfully chaotic action to mind. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a pantser hoping to discover the plot along the way. And that's usually what does happen. And then sometimes you then have to go back and make a lot of repairs to kind of make the plot make sense. But that is how I find it.
Now, there are many flashlights through the book, especially in the opening scene that we won't discuss. But did you mean there to be the metaphorical flashlight and the little illuminations Louisa gets about her history?
Well, yeah. So here's a little example of like where the pantser becomes the plotter, right? Because I was writing all this material and the flashlight had become kind of this recurrent motif, and I had not noticed, which happens a lot with me. And I think with writers in general, I think, you know, we have lots of ideas and some of them land and work often because there's symbolic value that we might not have consciously noticed. And then we maybe make use of the idea a bit more without noticing. And then maybe we finally do notice. And with me, I had drafted quite a lot of the novel and shared it with my agent, who's really incredibly astute reader. And she came back and said, I love, you know, the way the flashlight is playing this metaphorical role. And I said, oh, is it? Like I hadn't even noticed. But then I did notice and I was like, oh, I like that too. Then I became a plotter and started actually kind of looking for opportunities while trying not to overdo it, obviously. So there is a way in which I think the pantser can become more deliberative in her efforts. But it was something that took root kind of organically by itself first.
Can we turn out the lights?
It won't be dark.
You could pull the blinds down.
It still won't be dark. It will be dim, Dr. Brickner predicted, but he was already doing it. The blinds were an ancient, unreliable mess, and they clearly were never let down. As Dr. Brickner struggled with them, they fought back, their long metal strips rattling and seesawing slantwise and releasing a dust plume before they seemed to surrender and fall all at once. The dust, dissipating, glinted erratically, as if flashing a code. Where it crossed the slim rays of afternoon light streaming in through the gap that remained, where the blinds did not quite meet the wall. Dr. Brickner, reaching over his desk toward the chair where she sat, held the flashlight out to her. It was satisfyingly heavy. Louisa slid the plastic switch with her thumb, and a pale cloud of light appeared on the ceiling.
Oh, good, he said. I thought the batteries might have gone dead.
If they were, and this was an earthquake, then you'd be in trouble.
Very true.
Now, through the magic of editing, the listener will have heard clips of the book read by Eunice Wong. Were you responsible in any way for the casting of Eunice?
Oh, I'm so happy to say that I was not responsible for, but involved in. So when we, you know, my publisher and I were preparing the different versions of the book, you know, mostly concerned with the one in print, but the audio producer at my publisher gave me like the great fun honor of listening to sort of a collection of readers that they had selected that they thought would work. And they were all so, so good. And then when I heard Eunice's kind of, what they do is that each reader, you know, records a very short section of the book in their voice. They all read the same thing. So it's a bit like an audition. And each one that I listened to, I thought, oh, that's great. Oh, that's, oh, this, everyone was great. And then I got to Eunice's and it was just as if she already had done it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Her audition was the book. It wasn't a matter of imagining how she would read it, but as if she'd already read the whole thing and it just became unimaginable that anyone else would do it. And I was so happy that we had her, and she was so remarkable and so utterly meticulous in her preparation when she was getting ready to do, you know, it's a performance and it's grueling. It takes a long time to make these audiobooks. And when she was preparing, she sent me this list of pronunciation questions. And it's so funny because like writers, we're like working in our head and not out loud. And almost all of the pronunciation questions she had for me, I had no idea how to answer them. How is this person's name said? I was like, God, I have no idea. I kind of hear it in my mind, but when I try to speak it out loud, I don't really know. You know, how's this word pronounced? Ugh, no clue. I was luckily, a lot of the questions were about the Korean language and which pops up in the book at times. And I have this remarkable Korean teacher. And so I set up a Zoom with all three of us, and I've never had more fun. And, you know, my Korean teacher talked to Eunice about, who has no Korean background whatsoever, about, you know, how you would say these different words and the nuances. And it was just a load of fun and just great. And yeah, Eunice is such a star. I can't believe she did the book. I'm so thrilled with it.
Was there ever thought of you doing the book yourself? Because you read the short version of the book.
I don't know that there was any serious thought in the minds of the producers. I doubt it. I know authors sometimes do their own books, and I would be really flattered if I was ever seriously asked. It's very time consuming. I don't think that I could have done it. I think that I would have burned out pretty quickly. I really like reading aloud, and I most like reading other people's work aloud. I don't know that I would have survived the job of reading this entire book of mine out loud.
And now it's available in audio, and RNIB have also produced a Braille version. It's available for people for whatever reason do not have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Oh, it is, absolutely. I'm really, really thrilled that there will be a Braille version. And, you know, the audio version is another thing. Again, it's a version for, you know, people who either, as you say, don't have that visual relationship to print, or who might choose to listen, even if, you know, they might read print on other occasions. And I really like that these options exist. You know, I myself have kind of not found enough occasion to make use of audiobooks, except on a long driving trip when I found that, you know, for example, like listening to Sir Ian McKellen reading the Odyssey, you know, the Robert Fagles version of the Odyssey, it's like one of the most enthralling road trips I've ever been on, because like driving along on an Odyssey, listening to that audiobook. So I think that there are certain formats for me in which it's a completely separate new experience of a text. And so I like that there's different dimensions.
One thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little quick audio description of it?
The cover in the US is quite abstract, and it's beautiful. I love it. It's kind of half of this livid crimson, you know, orb that probably most people will think like of a setting sun. And this sort of ragged vertical edge that's cutting it in half that might make some people think of the tide line of the ocean or of like a torn piece of cloth. It's really quite remarkable. The UK version of the cover is very different, but has a similar feeling of sort of eerie, I hope intriguing, a bit desolate, but also, you know, a bit stirring. There's a black and white photograph of a road that winds away into the distance. The road is kind of glowing white, and otherwise it looks as if it's dusk, dark. It might be, you know, it might be that night is coming. And that photo is set against a quite vivid yellow. And it really, when my UK editor sent the mock-up of the cover to me, I immediately said, oh my God, it looks like a, you know, a poster from like some amazing, like French new wave cinema, like some film of the early 60s. So I think both covers have this kind of eerie, otherworldly sort of quality of like drawing you on into some journey that you're not sure what it's going to be.
It's daft having someone who teaches creative writing on not to ask them the question, what are some of your quick top tips for aspiring writers?
I think my top tip is to try to write as often as you can. I mean, that really is the, you know, that is the secret ingredient to success that I never consistently managed to adhere to. But if you can manage to write every day, even if it's just for kind of a fairly brief period of time, your writing is going to improve so rapidly, and you're going to figure out those different problems that whatever you're working on is presenting to you so much more quickly. Just, you know, it's like going to the gym, as none of us really like to do it, but you have to admit that if you do it every day, you see the results. And if you write every day, you will see the results. My other advice is always make sure you're reading a lot. You know, make sure that you're setting time aside to be reading whatever it is you're reading. That's the best possible school for learning how to write, is reading. And it's part of the work. It's not, it is enjoyable and it is an amusement, but it also is really part of the work. So what a great job that your job is actually to read a lot in addition to write.
She played the light over the ceiling, almost forgetting about him. The ceiling was far above her, twice as far as the extinguished overhead light, the hideous kind that looked like a huge upside-down ice tray suspended from wires. Beyond the enormous ice tray, the faint pool of light rippled over the ceiling and slid down the wall. It seemed alive, a being both at her command and mysterious to her.
Do-do-do-do-do,
she sang out, inexplicably goofy herself. She was singing the notes everyone nowadays recognized, the UFO's greeting from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Dr. Brickner laughed. They gazed up at the ceiling as if something were actually there.
Did you like that movie?
Asked his voice, which she found was more tolerable than when she had to look into his face. It scared me. She was surprised and annoyed by her honesty.
Why?
She shrugged, waving the beam over the ceiling as if in erasure. Just in a fun way, like Halloween stuff.
Is that really all you meant?
She'd let the door open a crack, but he was too large and slow to slip through.
Flashlight by Susan Choi is available in all formats commercially and also available in audio and braille from RNIB Talking Books. And Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.
And we'll have more from Susan in Books of My Life after this.
Hello, I'm John Cormack, and I've been reading these books, crikey, when I think about it, 18, 19 years now. Seems like a lifetime, man and boy. I suppose favourite books, well, Roddy Doyle springs to mind, all the Roddy Doyle, the Barry Town trilogy, which leap off the page and are wonderful to read. But I think one that would even surpass that is a book called The Butcher Boy by Patrick McCabe. That was his first novel, and shocked and, I must say, frightened the life out of me, and it was splendid to read.
When I was a young lad, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, I lived in a small town where they were all after me on account of what I had done on Mrs. Nugent. I was hiding out by the river in a hole under a tangle of briars. It was a hide me and Joe made. Death to all dogs who enter here, we said. Except us, of course. You could see plenty from the inside, but no one could see you. Weeds and driftwood and everything floated downstream under the dark archway of the bridge, sailing away to Timbuktu. Good luck now, weeds, I said. And then I stuck me nose out to see what was going on. Plink. Rain, if you don't mind. But I wasn't complaining. I liked rain. The hiss of the water and the earth so soft, bright green plants would nearly sprout beside you. This is the life, I said. I sat there, staring at a water drop on the end of a leaf. It couldn't make up its mind whether it wanted to fall or not. It didn't matter. I was in no hurry. Take your time, drop, I said. We've got all the time we want now. We've got all the time in the world.
I think it's a great service, the RNIB Talking Books. And it's also quite personal for me because my mother lost her sight in the 5 years before she died and used to get the books, which was lovely and a great comfort to her. The only slight downside with that was that she used to get my books and I used to get notes on the phone. As in, I don't like the way you did that.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Susan Choi for the books of her life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, there's so many, but you know, one series I'm thinking of, I can't choose a book, is Susan Cooper wrote a series of books called, the whole series is called The Dark is Rising. And the very first one of the series was called, I believe, Oversea Under Stone. So intriguing and gives you a sense of things happening that you can't see or understand. It's wonderful books.
Where is he? Barney hopped from one foot to the other as he clambered down from the train, peering in vain through the white-faced crowds flooding eagerly to the St. Austell ticket barrier. Oh, I can't see him. Is he there? Of course he's there, Simon said, struggling to clutch the long canvas bundle of his father's fishing rods. He said he'd meet us with a car. Behind them, the big diesel locomotive hooted like a giant owl, and the train began to move out. Stay where you are a minute, Father said, from a barricade of suitcases. Mary won't vanish. Let people get clear. Jane sniffed ecstatically. I can smell the sea. We're miles from the sea, Simon said loftily. I don't care. I can smell it. Trewizick's 5 miles from St. Austell, Great Uncle Mary said. Oh, where is he? Barney still jigged impatiently on the dusty grey platform, glaring at the disappearing backs that masked his view. Then suddenly he stood still, gazing downwards. Hey, look! They looked. He was staring at a large black suitcase among the forest of shuffling legs. What's so marvellous about that? Jane said. Then they saw that the suitcase had 2 brown pricked ears and a long waving brown tail. Its owner picked it up and moved away, and the dog, which had been behind it, was left standing there alone, looking up and down the platform. He was a long, rangy, lean dog, and where the sunlight shafted down on his coat, it gleamed dark red. Barney whistled and held out his hand. "Darling, no," said his mother plaintively, clutching at the bunch of paintbrushes that sprouted from her pocket like a tuft of celery. But even before Barney whistled, the dog had begun trotting in their direction, swift and determined, as if he were recognising old friends. He loped round them in a circle, raised his long red muzzle to each in turn, then stopped beside Jane and licked her hand. "Isn't he gorgeous?" Jane crouched beside him and ruffled the long, silky fur of his neck. "Darling, be careful," Mother said. "He'll get left behind. He must belong to someone over there." "I wish he belonged to us." "So does he," Barney said. "Look." He scratched the red head, and the dog gave a throaty half-bark of pleasure. "No," Father said. The crowds were thinning now, and through the barrier they could see clear blue sky out over the station yard. "His name's on his collar," Jane said, still down beside the dog's neck. She fumbled with the silver tab on the heavy strap. "It says Rufus, and something else. Trewizick. Hey, he comes from the village." But as she looked up, suddenly the others were not there. She jumped to her feet and ran after them into the sunshine, seeing in an instant what they had seen, the towering, familiar figure of Great Uncle Merry, out in the yard waiting for them.
That's Marjorie Anderson reading from Oversea Under Stone, The Dark is Rising, Book 1 by Susan Cooper. Available, with the rest of the series, from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
I reread The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald all the time, even though I know it like the back of my hand, and even though like I have a lot of problems with the characters are so annoying and the plot is so implausible, but the sentences are so good. Oh, the sentences are so good. I could read them again and again, and I do.
In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice that I've been turning over in my mind ever since. Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone, he told me, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had. He didn't say any more, but we've always been unusually communicative in a reserved way, and I understood that he meant a great deal more than that. In consequence, I'm inclined to reserve all judgments, a habit that has opened up many curious natures to me, and also made me the victim of not a few veteran bores. The abnormal mind is quick to detect and attach itself to this quality when it appears in a normal person. And so it came about that in college I was unjustly accused of being a politician, because I was privy to the secret griefs of wild, unknown men. Most of the confidences were unsought. Frequently I have feigned sleep, preoccupation, or a hostile levity, when I realized by some unmistakable sign that an intimate revelation was quivering on the horizon. For the intimate revelations of young men, or at least the terms in which they express them, are usually plagiaristic and marred by obvious suppressions. Reserving judgments is a matter of infinite hope. I am still a little afraid of missing something if I forget that, as my father snobbishly suggested, and I snobbishly repeat, a sense of the fundamental decencies is parceled out unequally at birth. And, after boasting this way of my tolerance, I come to the admission that it has a limit. Conduct may be founded on the hard rock or the wet marshes, but after a certain point I don't care what it's founded on. When I came back from the East last autumn, I felt that I wanted the world to be in uniform and at a sort of moral attention forever. I wanted no more riotous excursions with privileged glimpses into the human heart. Only Gatsby, the man who gives his name to this book, was exempt from my reaction. Gatsby, who represented everything for which I have an unaffected scorn. If personality is an unbroken series of successful gestures, then there was something gorgeous about him, some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life, as if he were related to one of those intricate machines that register earthquakes 10,000 miles away. This responsiveness had nothing to do with that flabby impressionability which is dignified under the name of the creative temperament. It was an extraordinary gift for hope, a romantic readiness such as I have never found in any other person and which is not likely I shall ever find again. No. Gatsby turned out all right at the end. It is what preyed on Gatsby, what foul dust floated in the wake of his dreams, that temporarily closed out my interest in the abortive sorrows and short-winded elations of men.
Peter Brook, reading from F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, one of a number of versions available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend?
Oh, I'd love to. I want to recommend a book by Andre Alexis, is a Canadian writer, called 15 Dogs. And it's actually just out in a 10th anniversary edition. It came out in 2015, and now it's coming out again, 2025, in a 10th anniversary edition from its Canadian publisher. This book blew my mind, and I just taught it to my students last week, and they also loved it. And it's an incredible book. I don't even really want to give away the conceit. I just want the reader to kind of dive in and discover it, but it's like nothing I've ever read. So good.
One evening in Toronto, the gods Apollo and Hermes were at the Wheat Sheaf Tavern. Apollo had allowed his beard to grow until it reached his clavicle. Hermes, more fastidious, was clean-shaven, but his clothes were distinctly terrestrial. Black jeans, a black leather jacket, a blue shirt. They had been drinking, but it wasn't the alcohol that intoxicated them. It was the worship their presence elicited. The wheat sheaf felt like a temple, and the gods were gratified. In the men's washroom, Apollo allowed parts of himself to be touched by an older man in a business suit. This pleasure, more intense than any the man had known or would ever know again, cost him 8 years of his life. While at the tavern, the gods began a desultory conversation about the nature of humanity. For amusement, they spoke ancient Greek, and Apollo argued that, as creatures go, humans were neither better nor worse than any other, neither better nor worse than fleas or elephants, say. Humans, said Apollo, have no special merit, though they think themselves superior. Hermes took the opposing view, arguing that, for one thing, the human way of creating and using symbols is more interesting than, say, the complex dancing done by bees. Human languages are too vague, said Apollo. That may be, said Hermes, but it makes humans more amusing. Just listen to these people. You'd swear they understood each other, though not one of them has any idea what their words actually mean to another. How can you resist such farce? I didn't say they weren't amusing, answered Apollo, but frogs and flies are amusing too. But if you're going to compare humans to flies, we'll get nowhere, and you know it. In perfect, though divinely accented English, that is, in an English that every patron at the tavern heard in his or her own accent, Apollo said, Who'll pay for our drinks? I will, said a poor student. Please, let me. Apollo put a hand on the young man's shoulder. My brother and I are grateful, he said. We've had 5 Sleemans each, so you'll not know hunger or want for 10 years. The student knelt to kiss Apollo's hand, and when the gods had gone, discovered hundreds of dollars in his pockets. In fact, for as long as he had the pants he was wearing that evening, he had more money in his pockets than he could spend, and it was 10 years to the instant before their corduroy rotted to irrecoverable shreds. Outside the tavern, the gods walked west along King Street. I wonder, said Hermes, what it would be like if animals had human intelligence. I wonder if they'd be as unhappy as humans, Apollo answered. Some humans are unhappy, others aren't. Their intelligence is a difficult gift. I'll wager a year's servitude, said Apollo, that animals, any animal you choose, would be even more unhappy than humans are if they had human intelligence.
$15, the 10th anniversary edition by Andre Alexis, is available in audio commercially, as read by the author. And once again, Susan Choi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.